Welcome back. Welcome back to Wednesday Night Central. Dave, you all right to pray for us?
Yeah,
amen. Great. Well, this term we're going to split the term into two halves, or two unequal halves, actually, into two pieces. First 6 weeks, we're going to look at understanding and engaging the world. Explain that in a sec. And the second half, we thought we'd try and basically have a look at an actual Bible book. So the second half, we're going to look at Malachi. Especially because we're doing some more topical stuff at church, try and make sure we're still looking at books of the Bible. Obviously, the way God revealed himself to us wasn't through topics. He could have given us a theology book where he said, right, first of all, I'll tell you all about sin. Then I'll tell you all about the cross. Then I'll tell you all about, I don't know, angels. But instead, he tells us in the Bible, in the way the Bible's written as a story. So that's why most of the time we spend in series looking at books of the Bible. But it's useful sometimes to sort of zoom out, I suppose, and put things together into topics, which is what we're going to do now. And so for 6 weeks, engaging the world, understanding and engaging the world. I put on the sheets there that it's a bit of a truism. Do you know the phrase, in the world, but not of it? Not in the Bible. It's true. I think it's a true thing. But it's not actually in the Bible, specifically, that phrase. Jesus says something very similar, though, which is where it's come from, the Bible verse at the top of the sheet. Praying to his Father, I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but you keep them from the evil one. They're not of the world, just as I am not of the world. That catchphrase, in the world, not of it, we're told so often that's how we're to act as Christians. But actually, it's staggeringly difficult when you start trying to work out what it actually looks like. Almost always, as Christians, we find ourselves, well, I think we do anyway, either swerving off into avoiding the world, so we sort of run away, or we just basically give up and become just like the world. And actually, I think the most common way that we end up acting is being in the world in terms of actually, after we've been Christians for a while, we sort of, you know, we have our spurt, we get converted, and we're all very excited, and then we learn lots to start with, and then we sort of plateau, and actually we end up behaving after a while not that much differently from our neighbours. So if you live on a nice street with nice neighbours, other than the fact that we go to church and Wednesday Night Central and they don't, often there's not a huge amount of difference in our lifestyles on lots and lots of issues. So we become quite like the world, and yet also if we've been Christians for quite a long time, increasingly our Christian friends become dominant, and that's a good thing, of course. But we lose contact with non-Christians. Maybe we've got colleagues left, but we don't have many good non-Christian friends. So we end up out of the world in terms of relationships and pretty much in a Christian huddle where the only people we really see are Christians, but in the world in terms of behaviour, where our lifestyles kind of reflect on the whole the non-Christian world around us. And that's the exact opposite of what Jesus is aiming for. So these 6 weeks are really trying to help us think through how do we reverse that, so that we can actually genuinely make contact with the world around us, both in terms of understanding them and then engaging them with the gospel, but do it in such a way that we don't become just corrupted and we don't just end up, well, actually living lives like everybody else. It's quite ambitious for 6 weeks, but I hope we'll have a crack anyway. If you've got a Bible then, do you want to turn to John 17? Because this is the main... the main passage, as I said, that this theme comes from. John 17. John 17 is a prayer. It's a prayer of Jesus to his Father the night before he goes to the cross. We won't go through it all, but can someone read from verse 11 to 19? It's all right. 12. Thanks, Claire. So the setting here is Jesus knowing that within 24 hours he's going to be gone. That the disciples who he's been able to look after, shepherd, teach, correct when they go wrong, are going to be suddenly leaderless, at least in terms of having physical Jesus there on earth with them. And so he's praying, looking forward. And the two big needs, which is where the two big themes of these sessions come from, are both their protection, so depending on what words or what version you're reading, Time and again, he talks about, say, verse 12, how I have guarded them, or I have protected them, or I have kept them, and not one of them has been lost, except Judas. So their protection. Or also, and if we were to read the rest of the prayer, this would become more clear too, their mission in the world. Verse 18, as you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. Christ came into the world to save sinners, to go and reach the lost. Well, now the disciples are going to be the messengers of that salvation. They'll be taking the message of Christ crucified out into the pagan cultures. And you can imagine, for 11 disciples about to go and take on the whole world, that's a heck of a job. You know, we feel intimidated, being a small church, or when there's only four or five of us around. They've got to take on the whole world. So it's huge things that Jesus is praying for. And the two are absolutely linked. Unless the disciples stay pure, or sanctified, as Jesus calls it, then their witness is obviously going to tail off. We all know horror stories of hugely compromised Christians who maybe can preach the right message, but actually their lifestyle, they show that actually they're not really much different from anyone else around. What I've tried to put on the sheet there is a sort of walkthrough of those verses. So as I say, verse 11 is the situation. I am no longer in the world, but they will be. I'm coming to you. So Jesus is going to heaven. So far, verse 12, while I was with them, I kept them in your name, which you've given me, and I've guarded them, not lost anyone except Judas, as was foretold. So already the hint there is that there's a danger. Disciples can get lost, can be snatched, pulled away. How is Jesus going to protect them? Well, not by sucking them out of the world, zooming them off to heaven, but verse 14, I've given them your word. So the protection is going to come through the word. It's as they feast on the word and take the word into them, ultimately for us by now the Bible, that they'll be protected. But again, straight away, I've given them your word and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, as I am not of the world. The fact that they've got Jesus' word in them, they're now gospel believers, will lead them into conflict, will lead them into opposition. It's a choice between word or world. And you can't have both in Jesus' outlook. If you have the word, if you're sanctified, if you're one of Jesus's, then you can't have the world. Okay, can't have both. Verse 15, I don't ask you that you take them out of the world, but you keep them from the evil one. So he's not looking for an escape. He's not sending in the seals to sort of grab them and parachute them off to the Bible Belt. He wants them in the world, in the messy situation, in the difficult situations. And so he prays protection, not just from the world. The world, I should say, by the way, is a sort of John's word for, I suppose, those people who aren't Christians and all that goes along with that. Okay, so they're going to have to stay engaging with non-Christian culture, people, all the rest of it. And behind it all, the sort of shadowy presence of, well, the evil one, the devil. So he'll be at us too. Verse 16, they're not of the world, just as I'm not of the world. So we're new people, different people. And so the prayer, verse 17, sanctify them. To sanctify is another word for holy. Make them holy. And again, how's it going to happen? Well, through the Bible. And just note there that it depends what version you've got again, but in mine it says, sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. It's not bad grammar. If you were writing that, you'd normally say your word is true, wouldn't you? You'd talk about the Bible being true. Jesus doesn't use an adjective there. It's not a describing word. It's not that the Bible is described as true. He says your word is truth, i.e. it is the standard of truth. It's not that there's some sort of, you know, we look at the Bible and we weigh it up and we decide, yeah, okay, I've decided based on my criteria the Bible is true. No, it's the other way around, says Jesus. If you want to know what's true in the world, what's good, what's right, what's wrong, it's not that you assess the Bible and if you're sort of a good person, you'll give it a tick. It is the judge. So if you're going to be a real disciple, you always have the Bible. We've used this illustration before, but the Bible is above you. It's the judge, not you. It's not up to me to decide whether I agree and decide the Bible is true. The Bible is truth. And that's what will mark out a disciple. And so after you've sanctified them, what's the final goal? Well, for their sake, I consecrate myself. Sorry, verse 18, as you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world, the mission. Now, to try and sort of get a grip on the scale of what's going on here, imagine you're a Christian and you were suddenly, for whatever reason, packed off with your family, your kids, to live in, let's say, Mecca. Okay? The culture shock you'd experience there is something like the culture shock that the disciples were about to experience. Now, they were Christians and weren't able to settle into the Jewish culture around them anymore. They were going to be distinct, and it would cause immense trouble. For many Christians, that's still the case, obviously. In Islamic countries, a good example. But in many cultures around the world, in China, all sorts of places where the church is persecuted, to be a Christian marks you out as radically different, and you will know about it straight away. There's no hiding it. There's no sort of accommodation with the world. It's a really straight either or. If you were dumped in Mecca, you'd suddenly have to make all sorts of decisions and think about things that at the moment we tend not to really think about as Christians. So you'd have to think about how you're going to dress. What kind of food are you going to eat? Are you going to go along with the local sort of food customs? Are you going to eat pork? Are you not going to eat pork? Are you going to send your kids to the local school, or are you not going to send them to the local school? Are they going to be able to play with the kids around them or not? All sorts of decisions, because the culture is so very obviously anti-Christian. And I think it's fair to say that for a long time in the UK, that clash between the culture around us and the church hasn't been, at least it hasn't been as significant as the clash between someone living in an Islamic culture and the church. Now, of course, there were lots of nominal Christians. Of course, there was lots of people who would go along to church on Sunday but weren't real believers. But on the whole, if you believed, for example, that sex was for marriage, well, most other people thought that too. You weren't a weirdo. You know, that wasn't a bigoted point of view, or homosexuality. It wasn't a bigoted position to think that it was wrong. Even 30 years ago, not that long ago, I turned 30 a few months ago, so I'm using 30 as a not long amount of time now. So when you're reassuring myself. It's still the case. You know, Section 20 or whatever it was. You know, increasingly, it's very obvious, isn't it, that the gap between church and culture is going to get bigger and bigger, and therefore we'll increasingly find ourselves more in a disciple-like situation. And so we will have to be more discerning about the culture around us. We won't just be able to assume that everything is kind of okay. And don't forget, too, that Satan masquerades as an angel of light, as we're told in 2 Corinthians. He's not an idiot. He's not going to get us, probably, as if we're evangelicals. He's not going to get us by turning us into Satanists or, I don't know, witches and warlocks and getting us worshipping the devil and sacrificing virgins and all the rest of it. And neither is he particularly likely to get us by turning us, 20 of us here tonight, into Hindus or Muslims. He's much more subtle than that, and he's much more capable. He's a much more deadly opponent than that. He masquerades pretending to be good, an angel of light. We'll come back to that in a bit. But the point so far really is that actually that the world around us is often a far more subtle danger to us than perhaps we realise. So we're not to be of the world. You need to watch out. But instead, just over the page, we're to be in the world. As I've said already, the answer for Jesus isn't to send the angels as a kind of extraction squad to every time someone becomes a Christian, they get whipped off to heaven. On the contrary, he sends them almost further into trouble. And many times, some of the people who've got the best grip on the gospel are the ones who, far from ending up in a safer place, you know, disappear off in, you know, to the far ends of the earth on missionary work. Often, the further sanctified you get, the more dangerous your life gets, or the more countercultural you get. So what will protect them? Well, again, only his word. The sort of monk thing where you disappear into your holy huddles, or the style, I think they're called the stylites. These guides who, is that right? The guys who lived on pillars in the desert, you know, cross their legs and sit up there, and mental. It's probably not a massive danger either, but the idea is that you're so full of the word, to use the food analogy again, you've chomped it down so much that actually you become all but impervious to the world around you, that the influence goes the other way. The salt and light metaphors that Jesus uses. Is that we're having the good effect on the culture or people around us rather than it getting us. So just as a sort of bit of a discussion, 5 minutes or so, if you've read the Screwtape Letters, this is basically the conceit there. If you were a junior demon, okay, and you were given the project of making Christchurch Derby, or your family, if you like, spiritually impotent, just, you know, cold and all the rest of it, what strategies would you use? What would you do? And for the less imaginative, basically the same question, a different way around. What are some of the pressure points where Christians, in our culture at least, in Derby 2011, become too like the world, either in terms of beliefs, by which I don't just mean, you know, we won't believe the gospel. I mean things like we don't believe in truth anymore, or you know, we don't believe that you can tell anyone else they're wrong, that sort of thing, or more obviously in lifestyle. Have 5-10 minutes on that, and then we'll come back together. Try not to look too far ahead, even with the funky cartoons that have exercised my clip art skills to the max. Okay, even if you haven't quite finished all the questions, have a flick over the page. Yeah. This is what I think you should have got. What we'll do is we'll go through this, and then if there are questions off the back of either this page or the little discussions you just had, fire them after we've had a chance to go through what I think's going on in Romans 1. Romans 1, 18 to 32, I think is the most helpful passage in the Bible for understanding the mind of a non-Christian. The people Paul's talking about here is everybody. Okay, he's not just talking about people in Rome as if it's some particular Roman problem. He's talking about everybody from creation onwards, okay? Pre-becoming a Christian, I suppose you ought to put in, okay? I think there's four big things that come out. The first is that everybody knows God. It's verse 21, I mean, it's there time and time again. But for although they knew God, because God made himself clear, they know him. And that word know isn't the sort of, it's not like an academic word in the way that you might know that Paris is the capital of France or know the French for a dog or something. It's know in the sort of personal sense, in the way that you know your friend Tom or whatever. Okay, so it's a personal connection with God that every single human being, without exception, who has ever breathed on the face of the planet has. And that's huge. It's not that he's not saying, as sometimes this is read, that actually because God's revealed himself in nature, if you put together a clever enough argument about how, I don't know, we're exactly the right number of miles away from the sun and we're spinning at exactly the right speed and all the rest of it, you know, if you're clever enough, you'll be able to work out that God exists. That's not what he's saying, although that's probably true as well. He's saying that everybody has this innate, basically, knowledge of God because God is a good communicator. Secondly, it tells us that we exchange that truth of God for a lie and suppress the truth. So although the truth gets to us, we push it down. The illustration I really like on this one is the idea of if you're listening to a radio and it suddenly goes fuzzy, or watching the TV, at least before digital came in or whatever, or internet TV, and it goes all wavy, there are two possible problems with it. One is that the BBC aren't beaming out the signal properly anymore, so the communication isn't coming through. The second problem could be that your radio's knackered, your receiving aerials have gone wonky, and that the thing's off. Sorry. Engineers sniggering in the corner. The problem with us is the second one. Okay, it's our receiving that's gone wrong. The message comes through loud and clear from the BBC, loud and clear from God, and then we scramble the channel. I used to have one of those TVs when I was little where you had to turn it to find the, you know, the right channel. Yeah, black and white. You turn it and you find the right. just backward in Dorset, we only just got electricity, but and it's like that. It's like I'd scramble the TV channel wrong. So it gets through. But the second thing there is, it's not that we just get rid of the signal. It's not like we lob the TV out. We change it. We turn it. We change God. Suppress the truth. We can't stop worshiping and serving, to use the passage's language. Now, of course, it can be literal. You can become a Muslim and worship Allah. Or it can be, for most of us in the UK, something far more subtle. We live for our careers or our, you know, the usual stuff. Relationships, greed, money, all sorts of things we can live for. And we become, Bible language, idolaters. Still worshiping and serving. You can't stop worshiping and serving. You can't stop being religious if you you know, excuse the word, it doesn't mean explicitly you're going to go to a worship service to worship a car or something, but you'll become an idolater. Idolatry, in turn, you exchange your God, that leads to sin, partly because God pushes you into it, so it's a punishment. Sinning is a punishment from God. Verse 24, God gave them up in the lusts of the heart to impurity. We're not really going there tonight. It's not quite the sort of angle, but in this passage, for example, homosexuality is the punishment from God. He gives them over to it. There's a massive can of worms. But the bigger point from the second half of the passage is when you worship a false god, it leads you into sin. So you get the massive list of all sorts of sins. They come from false worship. But, and this is the kind of amazing thing, you can't fully stop knowing God. Some of the signal just will continue to get through. You're made in his image, for instance. And doesn't matter what you do to yourself, you can tattoo yourself, cut yourself, all sorts, you're still in his image. You can't get rid of that. And verse 32 at the end, though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. They know it. Even when they're doing it, they know it's wrong and that it's deserving of death. They know it's really wrong, not just sort of a bit naughty. People, even in the flights of this idolatrous, gossiping, slandering, insolent, homosexuality, all the rest of it, still know it's wrong. You can't get rid of it, finally. It's like if you've ever been in a swimming pool as a kid and you try and push your sort of beach ball under, and you push it under the water, and then it kind of whoop, pops up over there, and so you run over there, and you try and push it down again. That's what non-Christian life is like. Always trying to suppress God, but bits pop up. So they'll say there's no God, but then they say that they do believe in absolute truth or something. Although we'll come back to that in a few weeks, about how you can use that verse. We'll explain it more carefully in evangelism. But a fascinating insight into the minds of non-Christians. And just at the end there, it's not just that they do those things, but give approval to those who practice them. You know, you catch a kid doing something naughty, if they're in a group, and you say, look, you know, Tim, did you take that sweet? Johnny did it too. Straight away, isn't it? Blame shifting and get other people in on it. That's why you have lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, whatever it is, societies at universities. You ban people together in societies because you can all tell each other it's fine. Not many people, some do, I know, but not many people go out on, you know, get completely drunk, sat at home on their own. Far more people go out and get hammered in a group. It's the peer thing. You get people doing the same thing. And first of all, it makes you feel better about yourself. Hey, this is what everybody does. And also, of course, at the same time, it pressurizes other people into joining in. And that's the pressure from the world. We're back full circle to the John 17 thing. The world, non-Christian people and non-Christian society, culture, presses in on us in an attempt. It's a massive attempt at self-justification. We're fine as people who don't worship God. Look, everyone's doing it. We're all the same. Just let me stop there on Romans. Any questions on the Romans 1 bit, either from your discussions or from that little summary? And then we're going to do a so what finale with the funky artwork.
Not a question, but an observation.
Even better.
The Paul says that God gives us up. God actually gives us what we want. So we say, well, actually, I want the things of the world. I want to follow the things of the world. God actually gives us up.
The no excuse thing's huge, isn't it? Otherwise, if someone who died and they'd never heard the gospel, obviously, if God hadn't made himself clear, he could just turn up at heaven and say, what do you mean you exist? You know, no, God's communicated. And that, as Tim points out, the passage begins, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. It's not that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven by God lobbing thunderbolts at people. The wrath is revealed by them, by God giving them what they want, sin. So the sin is the wrath of God being played out. So no atheists, even Dawkins believes in God and knows it's true at some level. I'd love that. I'd love to have a conversation with him and say that. See, yeah. We are going to come back to this to work out how you actually talk about people with this thing. It's not that you walk out and go, and when someone says, "I'm an atheist," you say, "No, you're not." And they say, "Yes, you are." You say, "No, you're not." And you just sort of shout at each other until, you know, one of you gives in or punches the other one out. Sorry, I've just lost my place. Okay. So the last point we made there was that because of this repression of God, everybody sort of knows God, or does know God, but tries to invent ways of getting around it and brings other people in on it. Okay, this big self-justification. Second paragraph up from the bottom. That last point is vital in terms of understanding the world around us, the culture around us, the world, as John calls it. It's not neutral. Okay, nothing under the face of the sun is neutral. People who write books are serving, they are idolaters or Christians. There's no two ways about it. People who release music, write plays, produce TV shows. Now, I'm not saying they've necessarily got an explicit agenda that they are setting out trying to convince you of, although often actually on those sort of things they have, but they are either sticking to the truth, God and his truth, so writing in a way that reflects that, or they're not. And if they're not, they're preaching to you. Lady Gaga and, I can't remember who I put on the sheet, Lady Gaga, Hugh Hefner, the National Curriculum, the Archers, the entire advertising industry. If they're not Christian, a wild stab in the dark, then they're not neutral, they're part of the world. And Jesus is really blunt on this one in a way that I think we're not great at. You know, if you're not for me, you're against me. It, light and darkness. Born again, not born again. Dead, alive. Now, because of this common, what's called common grace, because of the fact you can't completely suppress God, of course it doesn't mean that everything that any non-Christian produces is absolutely awful. So on that last paragraph there, how do we respond? Does it mean we flee away? Or we, you know, we bung the TV in the bin, never listen to the radio, never pick up a book, a magazine, unless it's the Bible or some sort of hideously cheesy Christian novel? No. There is a danger of naivety, okay, and that's probably for most of us more the problem. We think it's fine to just take in all the TV and whatever that we, you know, we can, and we think it doesn't affect us. It's somehow sort of okay. Well, that's naive. But you can go the other end. The fact that everyone has some knowledge of God remaining means that there's going to be some good in everything that's produced. The old catchphrase, the devil's got no tunes. The devil can't create out of nothing. Only God can do that. What the devil does is take good stuff and corrupt it. So even something hideous, what example did I use? Where are we? Yeah, Playboy magazine, okay, hideous. Sinful, awful, obviously, just to get that in before I make this point. That is reliant on good things, the beauty of women, the joy of sex. Now, it's hugely distorted, but it only works because they've got hold of something good that God has given and twisted it and suppressed it. We're going to think, I keep saying this, we're going to think through that a bit more too in future weeks. Quick questions before cartoons, just on that one. All far too excited by the cartoons. Okay, so the world around us is serving a false god, but can't fully serve a false god. There's always a bit of God's truth that shines through. This week, I suppose it's more on purity, that the watch out becoming like the world stuff. Here we go. So the final two pages are two of my best ever efforts with clip art. The vicious circle, okay, this is what not to do, but what often happens to us. So you've got a little man there, and he's rejected God. That's the Romans 1. So he's not a Christian, doesn't like God being in charge of the world. So what does he do? He ignores God, over to box 2, and he starts thinking, well, you know, he becomes an idolater. Instead of God being king, you know, what would it be like if I was king, or if I actually just gave my life to, let's do something simple like living for sex. Okay, that, you know, very simplistic, I know, but... So he might, yeah, that'd be bad. I'm going to suppress the truth of God, and I'm going to become a, you know, sex mad, whatever. So what does he do? Well, he goes to, and this is down to the third box, he goes to a cultural text, by which I just mean anything, you know, that man has made, magazine, a TV, anything like that, that confirms him in that worldview. So there he is, you know, reading a book or watching TV, and he watched his Friends, where every one of the characters seems to be sleeping with six different people an episode, and he's like, yeah, look, that's what everybody's doing, you know, sleeping around, it's fine. You know, he reads FHM or whatever, where it's all about, you know, how many girls can you score, and he's like, yeah, this is what the lads do. Goes down the pub and chats with his mates, and they're all about, you know, how many can you score this. And because he's getting all this input from the world around him, it sort of confirms him in his idolatry. And so he more and more lives in this dream world. It's not the real world, because in the real world, I don't know, sexual immorality is painful, it goes wrong, it ruptures relationships, it's evil, it's offensive to God. But he begins to live, this is why he's moved inside the bubble. He's living more and more in this dream world that he's kind of trying to force the real world into being. It won't work, but more and more he'll believe the lie. He'll believe the delusion. He'll get better and better at keeping the beach ball under the water, as it were. Quicker and quicker at suppressing it any time it pops up. And there's just a bit of a danger as Christians that we can fall into that on some things. If we're really undiscerning about all the stuff we take in, and to be honest, if you're parents or you will be parents in the future, this is huge. The amount of stuff kids have got access to now compared to the olden days, you know, where they had their Enid Blyton book or something. You know, internet, TV, endless TV, DVDs, oh, they can grab stuff on their phones. You know, just the poof, stuff they're fed. If you're not careful, we'll be constantly preaching to them. That's what these things are, preachers. Non-religious preachers. All the time. And so your attempt, if you know, your sort of 5-minute bedtime story at the end of the day is going head to head with hours and hours of secular stuff. Okay, it's really something to sort of think through. Well, how do you do it, therefore? If it's not running away, well, this is just a simple... This doesn't answer everything, of course, but the virtuous circle. I don't know why it starts with two. It beat me. Oh, yeah, even better. I hadn't seen that. Yeah. Okay, so there's a Christian. Okay, so he's sort of a bit happier about serving God. He's still got a bit of idolatry, a little thought bubble. No one's pure, obviously. We still struggle. Go to first three, sideways. 3A. Again, he's human. He's normal. He's engaging non-Christian culture. So he's watching TV. He's reading his little book. But always, remember, your word is truth. Always, he's thinking, what does God's word have to say about this? Okay, the Bible is above him, judging, assessing, giving him the truth on the stuff that he's taking in and his own thoughts. And obviously, to do that, he has to both feed on the Bible. So he's got to be taking it in himself, listening to it preached at church or reading it for himself, all that sort of stuff. And not just that, he's got to take it back into his life and let it speak to him all the time. It's basically about being discerning, thinking. And the more he does that, 3B, the idol is weakened, whatever particular struggles he might have. And he gets more satisfied with living in God's world. And importantly, God becomes more real to him. Yeah, it is better actually living your way, God. And so if you like, you get on a virtuous circle rather than a vicious circle that leads you up, not down. Just to give an example of this, George and I watched, did anyone see 2012? Spoof about the Olympics? Okay. Very funny. Just on recently, BBC, 6 episodes, sort of a bit like The Office, fly on the wall documentary, but mocking it, about the guys trying to put together 2012 Olympics. One of the little plot lines that ran through that was that the boss, who was basically a nice character, had a bit of a harridan for his wife. And his secretary was really nice, this sort of middle-aged single lady who clearly really fancied the boss, and she was lovely, and the wife came across as a bit of a, you know, witch. And you found yourself sort of hoping that he'd ditch his wife and go with the secretary, just subtly, you know, because that's the way that it was portrayed. It would be PG-rated. There's nothing, there's no sex in it, no violence in it, no nudity, anything like that at all. But it sort of, even by the last episode, it built this thing where it sort of climax and finish, and you don't quite find out what happens. But we finish watching it, and you kind of, your first reaction is, oh, I hope he goes to the secretary. I think, just a minute, that's me hoping that that he has an affair, adultery. And the writers of that program, whilst I don't think they've, I'm sure they haven't sat down and written a sitcom to try and persuade people to have affairs, but their worldview is so distorted that they can think that, it's leading to the conclusion that it'd be better to go with the one you love rather than stick with, your wife. It's awful. But to be honest, I'm not saying that I'm brilliant at, but unless you sit and think, oh, just a minute, what does the Bible have to say about that? It just subtly sort of feeds you these lies from the world. And the your word is truth. Sanctify me in your word begins to fade. That's enough really from the front. Anything on that, again, by way of questions, just as we finish and pray. It's not everything about how to engulf, protect yourself from the world around you, but it's some beginnings and principles. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of it is not at all subtle, and that definitely some of the screenwriters, they've got agendas, definitely. Yeah. I think the big thing is it's not. I think we can be simplistic and think that being a discerning Christian who's not giving in to the culture around them just means I don't watch 18s and I don't buy porn magazines or something. It's more than that. Those are so obvious, and they are wrong, but you see them coming. It's the subtle idols that you need to think about. And because they're different, nobody can just tell you. You know if actually for you, you could really do without watching another home decor program, because it's just, it's just sucking, I'm never going to be happy until we live in the 5-bedroom country house with a petting zoo out back or whatever. Another person needs to stop watching Top Gear or turn it down a bit. I'll turn off the test matches. Different for different people, but it's masquerading as Angel of Light, not watching The Exorcist and Driller Killer. Cool.